The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The Cypher Wheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CypherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CypherSafe.io to get the Cypher Wheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Noddle 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Noddle. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Noddle node, available at noddle.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello and welcome to another Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's seminar, our guest is Vijay Boyapati. Vijay is an old-time Bitcoiner who has written some excellent articles on Bitcoin, which he's now turning into a book called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, which is really one of the best things you can present to newcomers into Bitcoin if you're looking to present somebody with a case for why they should pay attention to Bitcoin. It's a very good introduction to the case for why Bitcoin and why Bitcoin is likely to go up and why it represents a unique opportunity that most people for all human history have had nothing like it. It's a great paper, and I've actually gotten the paper translated to Arabic and posted it on my website. So I have an Arabic website, saferdean.com/Arabic, where I have the translation of my book in Arabic available for download for free. And I've also gotten a bunch of good Bitcoin intro articles translated into Arabic and posted on their website. And Vijay's is one of these because I think it's quite good as an intro. And Vijay is previously a software engineer. He was going to do a PhD in computer engineering, but he was rescued from the jaws of academia. Right before he was about to start his PhD, he didn't, and he joined an obscure little startup. Some of you might have heard about it. It's called Google. He joined it when it was very few people had heard about it, and now I think most people have heard about it. So Vijay is also an old-time Googler. And it'll be interesting to hear about, you know, what this startup is up to. Vijay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Saif. I'm really honestly very excited to speak to you because you're fellow Austrian and your writing has influenced me a lot as well in my thinking about Bitcoin. So I'm very excited to talk about Bitcoin and Austrian economics with you.
Fantastic. So let's get started. Tell us, what is your bullish case for Bitcoin? Summarize it. Let's begin with that.
So it's an article that I first started writing in, I think about early 2017, when the price of Bitcoin was about $1,000. And, you know, I first found out about Bitcoin in 2011. And when I first discovered it, I had no idea what it was. And I was really curious as an Austrian, because clearly early on, I recognized it as a monetary phenomenon. This was a new monetary good. But why did it have any price? Why was it valued? It almost defied this sort of conventional Austrian thinking. It was a stunning development, I think, and it called for an explanation. Why is this new form of money that was created out of nothing? Why does it have economic value? So I've been obsessed with this question since 2011. And went down the rabbit hole and trying to wrap my head around it. And I felt like with Austrian economics, I had the tools to understand this. And it's something that I'd been thinking about before with gold. How is the price level of gold set? And I'd been thinking about that since, early 2000s. So my article is really trying to explain, where does the price level of Bitcoin come from? How has it gotten to where it is now, sort of path of monetization? Because the process of monetization with gold is something that took millennia. I mean, when first primitive man picked up gold, that was, thousands of years ago. From that earliest stage where early man picked gold up and valued it just as kind of a shiny collectible thing, to gold becoming global money in the 19th century, that process took a very, very long time. Whereas the process of monetization for Bitcoin is happening in such a compressed time frame that we get to see for the first time the process of monetization happening in real time. And I think we're learning stuff. Even as Austrians, I think we are learning new things. And I think it's important for us to have humility and recognize that maybe there are some things that we didn't understand about the process of monetization that we can improve and revisit our theories. So that's really what the article was about, is the motivation. I wanted to write it because I felt like by 2017, there's already a lot of misconceptions about Bitcoin, and people had some very poor arguments against it and didn't really understand it as a monetary phenomena. So I wanted to lay out an economic framework with which people could understand Bitcoin, understand why it has any price, what that path to becoming a global money would look like, and a little bit of the history as well, like the history of money and also the history of Bitcoin in the early days. It covers, a number of different topics, but it's really my way of explaining to people why Bitcoin is valuable, where it's going in terms of its development as money.
Yeah, and you make a pretty compelling case for why Bitcoin is likely to go up, the number go up technology of Bitcoin, why it goes up. And you define it in terms of, you look at it in terms of different sizes of market, in terms of different levels of capitalization to allow you to estimate the price. And I think you were one of the first people to really think about this systematically. So tell us, what are those price scenarios and adoption scenarios in your article?
Since I've been observing Bitcoin, there are really four valuation frameworks that I've seen people use to sort of think about how valuable could this become? And the first one is really the most dismissive one. It's kind of one that's used by people like Nouriel Roubini or Paul Krugman or Taleb. It's that there is no innovation here. There is no inherent value. This is kind of like some kind of Ponzi scheme or like the tulip mania, and people have just gotten excited about something which doesn't have any fundamental value. And if you believe this valuation framework, you'd think that the long-term price target on Bitcoin is zero. Eventually people are going to figure this out, and it's going to go back to a fundamental value of zero, because there isn't anything to it. The second valuation framework is that, okay, there's something here. This is clearly a new innovation, and Satoshi Nakamoto solved a problem in computer science that created something that does have some value, but is really limited value. It's limited to people who are ideologically aligned with Bitcoin, people who are libertarians or, you know, cypherpunks or very on the technological vanguard. But it's not going to be a widespread thing. It's just this small group of crazy people who are interested in it, or, you know, technologists in places like Silicon Valley. And if you were to believe that, you know, you could put a price target on Bitcoin, maybe somewhere between 10,000 and 100,000, because there are actually a lot of wealthy libertarians and, you know, wealthy people in Silicon Valley who are excited about it just for the technology aspect. The third valuation framework is this is actually a fundamental innovation to money. And when you compare it to competing monetary goods and systems, when you compare it to gold, you can see that Bitcoin has obvious advantages to gold. If you look at the attributes that make gold good as a store of value, and you compare Bitcoin to it, Bitcoin is superior along a number of those attributes. Certainly, obviously, it's much more transmittable across the world. It's very easy to send large sums of value across the world without anyone's permission, whereas doing that with gold is very risky and cumbersome and costly. And if you believe this, if you believe that Bitcoin is, you know, sort of similar monetary good to gold, it has similar scarcity properties, but it's superior along a number of the other attributes that make for a good store of value, then you'd think that Bitcoin eventually is going to surpass gold in market capitalization. And so you'd put a price target on Bitcoin, you know, somewhere in the range of $500,000 to $1 million, which is kind of comparable, will get Bitcoin to a comparable market capitalization to gold and perhaps surpass it because it is superior to gold. The final valuation framework, the fourth one, is that Bitcoin is eventually going to become the reserve currency of the world. It's going to attain the status that gold had in the 19th century. And if that was the case, then it becomes sort of a final means of settlement between financial institutions and nation states, and they will hold it on their balance sheet or in reserves for nation states. If you believe this valuation framework, then Bitcoin is going to represent the wealth of the entire world. And so you're going to have a price target on Bitcoin in the tens of millions of dollars. Now, I think Bitcoin is transitioning from the second valuation framework. People's mindset is sort of transitioning from the second to the third. They're starting to say, okay, Bitcoin could be gold, or it could be even more than gold. And I think once it gets there, once it gets to the level where people are comfortable with Bitcoin being sort of this non-sovereign store of value, which has a market capitalization similar to gold, I think it will begin to transition to being that global reserve currency. I think that process could take many years. I sort of have a viewpoint of Bitcoin as a transformative technology that will transform the world over a period of decades. So I'm, you know, in terms of price movements, I don't really like to make price predictions in the short term, but I'm extremely bullish about Bitcoin over the time frame that it will be important to my children.
Yeah, I think obviously I agree with you, and I am curious though, what are the best arguments that you would make for why Bitcoin could say get stuck at the, what I like to call the Esperanto stage, where it's a bunch of internet weirdos who use this weirdo internet money amongst themselves, and the rest of the world just carries on using normal people money. just like with Esperanto, you know, there's a small group of committed people who are who want to use this language. And there's an element of Esperanto where some of them don't even want mass adoption. You know, they're not out to replace national and traditional languages. They want to just have this as a global lingua franca for them, for people who want to talk Esperanto. You know, I think many people would generally default to this being the case for Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin, yeah, sure, okay, if you want to handle private keys and if you want to be a weird anarchist and run your own node and have hundreds of thousands of transactions every day of strangers being recorded on your node, sure, you know, there's, you know, it works. And so it'll always remain niche and it'll always remain a small, limited market. And then, of course, there's the level that maybe it just stays at the level of gold, where, you know, okay, fine, it's out there. People use it as a way to get around inflation. They can't really use it for jewelry like gold. So it'll end up somewhere in the range of what gold carries. But you and I think, would expect that once it hits either of these targets, you know, there's no stopping that train. The same dynamic that got it to that level will continue to carry it on. I'm curious, what do you think are the best arguments you could present for why that won't happen? Why could it get stuck at gold, or why would it get stuck at the Esperanto stage? Do you have any, or do you think that basically that, you know, that snowball is rolling and there's no stopping it?
I think this is, you know, this is a market process and process of price discovery, and it is important to have humility about this, and we don't necessarily know where it's going to end up. But I think the desire, the human desire to keep on saving safe and have the value of their savings be maintained over time is universal. I think everyone wants that. You know, you put your hard work in and you get some savings. You don't want your savings to be debased. Gold was money for most of human history. It was the global reserve standard in the 19th century. It's really an anomaly that gold stopped being money. And gold had some problems that Bitcoin doesn't have. Its physicality is actually a major disadvantage of gold, because the physicality makes it hard to store. It also makes it hard to transmit. So what that causes is tendency for gold to be concentrated in these financial institutions. People would deposit them at banks, and you'd have a concentration which made gold vulnerable to nation state attack. And that's really what happened. It wasn't like gold was rejected by the market. No, not at all. Gold was abrogated by the state. The nation state attacked gold, and it was vulnerable to nation state attack because it had these centralizing tendencies. I think fundamentally there is this human desire to want to have one's savings kept safe. And it's much more obvious and visceral to people who lived in countries where their government is so badly mismanaged that the monetary system has collapsed. People in those countries, you don't need to give them a long story about Bitcoin, about why it's valuable, why it's this cool technology. They understand instantly, like, you know, we want sound money. In the West, maybe because they haven't seen that collapse, at least in recent history, people may not think it's as obvious, but governments have this tendency over the long term to horribly mismanage economies and mismanage their money. And I think the situation we're in, the monetary situation we are in right now, is absolutely unprecedented, that you have these government bonds across the world which have negative interest rates. Governments are holding the short-term rate at zero. I think this is going to end very, very badly. People are going to be looking for a lifeboat. They're going to be looking for something to escape to. I think there's almost an inevitability, but that the world's savings are going to flee to Bitcoin. And once that happens, I think it's very hard for nation states to unwind that, as they did unwind gold. But, you know, I also have to say, I do have humility about this. This is a market process and we're learning. Maybe Bitcoin does get to the capitalization of gold. And maybe we discover in this price discovery process that that represents a number of people on Earth who really care about this, and the rest of the people are fundamentally statist, and they're happy to, live with their savings in a government money that can be debased. We don't know. We are learning this, and I think we need to be students as well as theoreticians and economists, and we need to watch this process and learn what we can.
I agree with you. Obviously, I always try and be careful talking about the future because it's not something that's easy to analyze. It's much safer to talk about the past and the present. But I still think the case ultimately for me comes down to the fact that it is human action that determines monetary status, and it's not laws and regulations. And so, as you said, people are going to want savings. People are going to want to have more money and more savings. And I think it's just inevitable that they are going to wise up to savings, or even if they don't wise up to the fact that this is better, there's the brutal reality of hard money, which is that if you hold hard money, it continues to appreciate over time, whereas if you hold easy money depreciates. And so the people who choose easy money, their choices don't matter much for very long. You progressively have less and less wealth. And so whatever you decide to do with it matters less and less over time because you're commanding a progressively smaller share of the liquidity pie. And I think this is really how I'd like to think of Bitcoin success. It's a matter of capturing liquid cash balances. How much of the world's liquid cash balances does Bitcoin have? And yeah, I think as it continues to grow, obviously the key point is there's no way of making more. So as demand grows, that just leads to the price going up. That's the only way that we can meet the excess demand. But that in turn drives more demand. And I don't see that dynamic stopping. The more demand comes in, the price rises. That incentivizes more demand. Nobody likes to stay poor. Nobody wants poverty. And so people are going to either figure it out or learn the very hard way. But it's difficult to see a situation where it stops growing. I think government bonds are just there for the taking. They're negative yields, they're high risk. Insane for me that anybody buys government bonds. Then again, if it doesn't make sense that they buy bonds, whatever reason that is driving them to buy bonds might be convincing enough 20 years from now as well. Perhaps. Michael Saylor has been saying quite frequently that he thinks, the Bitcoin doesn't challenge the dollar. And I'm trying to give that idea some serious thinking. And I think there is a case to be made there that perhaps Bitcoin challenges bonds and really inconveniences government financing, but that you continue with the dollar as a currency because you need it to pay taxes and they can still throw you in jail. And you'll have your central bank digital currency on your phone, which is going to be completely controlled by your central bank. And this will be full surveillance, and it'll be very politically correct in that you can only buy things that the government approves of. So no meat, no fossil fuels, none of those evil things that make life livable for most of us. It's going to be all soy and solar panels and so on. You can have this kind of economy subsist for perhaps a very long time while the price of Bitcoin rises in real terms, but few people keep savings in the dollar, but they still buy it every month in order to get their government rations of fiat food and all of the other fiat things that they can buy. So there's still some residual demand that keeps propping up the price, and everybody needs to buy it for taxation. And you can see how they can, with central bank digital currencies and all the surveillance capacity that they have, you can see how they could make it that you can't operate unless you accept dollars, and that with all the universal basic income and all the money being handed out to people, there's a lot of dollars out there for you to accept. So it'll always make sense for you to continue to accept your local fiat coin. So maybe that is the case. But even in that situation, I think if I was to play devil's advocate and think of the best case scenario in that case, I still would see that the price of Bitcoin will continue to appreciate over time. And so the dollar is going to continue to devalue in this situation, and people will know that it is devaluing. But the worse it gets, the more Bitcoin rises because Bitcoin is going to be the alternative. Bitcoin is going to be how you keep your savings. Bitcoin is going to be how you are able to buy meat, how you're able to buy gasoline, how you're able to stay warm in the winter, how you're able to buy all of the fun things that industrial civilization has given us over the last 200 years. You know, a lot of these things are becoming quasi-illegal these days through governmental regulations that are causing grid disruptions and so on. So even in that situation, you know, I don't see them being able to stop Bitcoin, and I don't see it quelling Bitcoin's rise. So I'd like to try and disagree with you about something, but it's very hard for
Yeah,
me.
it's interesting you're talking about this. It makes me think that there is already precedent for this. If you look at Argentina, the peso is used as the medium of exchange, but wherever possible, people have tried, I mean, historically have tried to save in dollars because the value of the peso is depreciating so quickly. So you have this sort of disconnect where some of the functions of money are handled by different monetary goods. The peso is used because of government force, is used as the medium of exchange, but the medium of sale or the store of value is the dollar. The problem really with that is that you don't have any financial infrastructure for the dollar in Argentina. So you don't have the banking system or whatever. Bitcoin has this huge advantage that the infrastructure is on the internet and can be used by anyone anywhere on earth. So I think it's a much more ideal a vehicle for savings to flee to because of that, because you're not sort of completely disconnected from any infrastructure. So I think that's a huge advantage for Bitcoin. And I think people really talk about money as being a medium of exchange. And in fact, most economists define it that way. But I think it's the store of value role where savings are held, which is by far the most important aspect of money, because that's where the power is. The economic power comes from the ability to control the pool of savings in the world. And that's represented by but what people want to store their value in. So the US could maintain, like you're saying, the US dollar as a medium of exchange and have some, source of demand by through taxation by saying we will only accept taxation remittable in dollars. That creates kind of a base layer of demand for their currency. But then what they lose is the power to inflate away the savings, which is a way of stealing people's savings. And so what you would see is in much, much higher interest rates because people would be keeping their savings not in the dollar, not in US Treasury bonds. They'd be keeping it in Bitcoin. And so the government would have to pay a much, much higher price to fund its operations. And I think another big benefit of this is that governments wouldn't be able to fund themselves through inflation. They'd primarily have to rely on taxation. They would have to go to the population, go into people's pockets, and take money directly. And I think, whatever role you think the state should have, I think taxation is a more honest system of funding than inflation because people see the money being taken out of their pockets and they get upset at that. And there's this natural political pushback where historically, whenever governments tax too much, it would eventually lead to revolution. People don't want their savings being taken in this way. It puts kind of a limit on how far governments could go. And if you sort of look at the Middle Ages, where you had not really nation states, but more like kingdoms, it was very hard to do things like raise armies and go and attack other places because of the cost of taxation. People would get upset and say, what benefit am I getting from this? And if they don't see a benefit from that, they push back, or you have a revolution and the king is killed or kicked out. It's really the development of the nation state and its desire and ability to inflate the money supply, which has allowed these gigantic wasteful projects, like trillions of dollars being spent on, bombing the sand in the desert in the Middle East to no benefit to anyone, actually to huge detriment to both the people in the Middle East and to people in the US. So that's, one of the reasons I'm most excited. The world's savings fleeing to a store of value that can't be inflated away will really have a limiting impact on what governments can do going forward.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And I think if that scenario does come to pass where, okay, maybe national currencies survive and they continue to operate as, you know, your local central bank's surveillance mechanism over you, Bitcoin can't fix that, perhaps, in terms of the government being able to point a gun to your head and threatening you with having to use a currency. But That's a paper tiger if it's not backed by the ability to inflate the currency away. As long as most people's and companies' savings go toward Bitcoin, then the devaluation of the currency doesn't add much economic value, doesn't rob many people of too much economic value. And so I prefer the complete dismantlement of the state, but I'll settle for declawing it. I think
that's a really good way of saying it. Yeah. Declawing the tiger.
Exactly. Declawing the tiger and turning it into a tame house cat, I think, is much better. You know, you feed it when you want and it doesn't threaten to eat your children. Okay, well, shifting gears a little bit, you talk about the hype cycles. You were also, I think, perhaps one of the first people to start thinking about Bitcoin in terms of the hype cycles. So what do you think of the, where are we now in terms of the Bitcoin? Well, how tell us a little bit more about the hype cycle mental model that you use and where we are right now.
Yeah, so like we're talking about earlier, this is the first time we've got to observe the process of monetization in real time. And one of the things we may not have known this, and we're learning this, is that the process of monetization seems to happen in these hype cycles, where you'll have people come in the early stages who, you know, recognize this as a fundamental innovation. They have very strong conviction, and the price is still very flat, but starts to move up because the people are accumulating and recognizing it's an important innovation to money. And then you get other people who recognize that the price is going up and say, well, this might be a good investment. And so they decide to buy. And then eventually you get like speculators coming in, and the price starts to go parabolic as people are looking for very quick profits. They want to make, you know, 50% or 100% in a month. And you get into the speculative mania. And it reaches a climax and then it crashes because the cohort of people who are interested in Bitcoin in that cycle is kind of exhausted. And then the price crashes, but it crashes down to a new plateau, which was higher than the previous plateau when people first got interested and saw this as an important innovation or technology. And what's I find most fascinating is these hype cycles have a fractal pattern of increasing magnitude. And what I mean by that is if you look at the price chart of the 2017 hype cycle and overlay it on the 2013 hype cycle, they look very, very similar. And the same could be said of the current hype cycle if you superimpose it on the 2017 cycle. They're very similar price characteristics. And this is not something we necessarily would have known as Austrian economists to try to reason about this deductively. We wouldn't have known that these hype cycles happen, but it seems to me it's almost inherent to the social dynamic of monetization, where it happens in bursts of enthusiasm. Now, the first hype cycle was just the people who recognized Bitcoin as like this new improvement or solution to a problem that they didn't think was solvable, the Byzantine generals problem. There was a small cohort of people, the cypherpunks and the computer scientists who had been thinking about this, you know, really deeply, who recognized there was something there, people like Hal Finney. The next hype cycle was the sort of early intrepid investors, people like the Winklevoss twins or Wences Casares, who saw this as like, you know, an important technology, and also people who are ideologically aligned with Bitcoin as something that could improve the freedom of the world. That was really the cohort of people who defined the next hype cycle. And then you got early retail investors in the 2017 hype cycle, where they started coming and saying, wow, this seems to be important or you know, good investment vehicle. But it was really the most intrepid investors, so the early adopters. This cycle, I think, can be characterized by institutional investors coming in, corporations coming in, and perhaps even nation states thinking about, you know, it surprised me. I thought that would happen a few cycles from now, but coming in and thinking, you know, maybe we should have some Bitcoin on our in our reserves. So, you know, that's kind of a description of the cohort of people that have been in each cycle. But the really interesting thing to me as an Austrian is that the process of monetization is happening in cycles. They're called Gartner hype cycles. They have this very particular pattern where the price sort of is flat and then starts increasing and goes up to a big parabolic climax and then collapses and gets to a new plateau. We wouldn't have known that, I don't think, just reasoning deductively, but we've learned it and we're observing this happen. And it's absolutely fascinating to me. I'd love to hear what you think, you know, as an Austrian who thinks deductively, but recognizes there's clearly a pattern happening here. What is the significance of that?
Yeah, I think it's probably not something that you would predict based on praxeological reasoning if left on your own. Like if you'd never seen a market and I told you, and I taught you Austrian economics, and then I told you, you know, what would you expect happened in the last 40 years? You probably wouldn't come up with this, no matter how much praxeology you read. And for listeners who aren't very familiar, praxeology is the Austrian method for studying economics, which is essentially the analysis of human action, where you think of economics in terms of human action. People act and their actions have consequences, and you reason about economic activity and economic actions through thinking through the consequences of human action. So these things, I think, you know, the hype cycles in markets, you may not really be able to predict them based on thinking through praxeology. But I think, you know, once you, as you were saying, you know, you can dig in and understand what is going on. And I think it's an explanation that has its heart in praxeology. So your explanation of the hype cycle is ultimately about humans acting. You know, a bunch of people come in and then another kind of people come in and then the price rises because so many people are coming in and then it crashes. So I think ultimately it is about human action. And I think it's also a good way of understanding, or maybe it's maybe a praxeological answer for the question of market efficiency and efficient market hypothesis. In that, in the efficient market hypothesis, or in a lot of strands of mainstream and neoclassical economics, there's this idea that if the knowledge is public, then everybody in the market knows it, and then everybody is able to act upon it, and so it is already going to be reflected in the price. And I've always found this to be just completely academic in the worst sense of the word, in the sense that it doesn't really matter. Because yes, if all the knowledge was available to everybody, then everybody would act upon it, then it would be reflected. But knowledge is not one central authority. And you see, and I'm sure you agree, you know, within modern economics, within modern mainstream economics, there's a very strong current, not more than just a current, it's a shaping, motivating assumption of there having to be somebody with a lot of knowledge who knows what is going on, of there being the possibility of somebody commanding all the knowledge, not just somebody commanding all the knowledge, but all of everybody commanding all the knowledge. But ultimately what this shows is that there is a conception of the knowledge as if it is just, you know, a specific set of facts. It's a highly simplified way of looking at the world, wherein, you know, it's the knowledge. You can think about it in terms of, say, public companies. Google is going to buy that company. That's not public knowledge today. Now it becomes public knowledge tomorrow. Then people act upon it, and then people buy the company stock, and then that company stock rises and so on. So that knowledge gets internalized. You can think about it in that way, perhaps, and you can make models, you can make mathematical models wherein it works in that sense. But in reality, in the real world, knowledge is not just one small set of facts. It's not even a large set of facts. It's an infinite amount of facts and opinions and interpretations and mental biases and ideologies and mental frameworks of looking at the world. It's, you know, the world is a big giant tower of Babel of people looking at the world in different ways, understanding different things and coming up with different conclusions. And so the notion that there is such a thing as just the knowledge is, I think, a very statist and to an extent Marxist, socialist understanding of how an economy functions. And it's really, you know, I think going back to the socialist calculation debate, it's important. One very underrated fact is that the socialist calculation debate was not a debate between mainstream economists and socialist economists. It was a debate between mainstream economists and socialist economists on one hand versus the Austrians on the other hand. So the mainstream is pretty much on board with all of the fundamental tenets of the socialist calculation debate. And that's, in my mind, where you come up with ideas like the efficient market hypothesis, because you think in this collectivist way in that there is the knowledge and the market is made up of, you know, the few big banks and the few big investment managers, and those are the ones that are moving the majority of the capital. And the market just follows that. But I think in the real world, and Bitcoin is a perfect example of this, knowledge is not evenly distributed and it's not even clear what the knowledge is. And, you know, in the case of Bitcoin, which is something really new, we see how knowledge actually works. And I think the hype cycle model is a much better way of understanding the knowledge and the efficiency of the market than the efficient market hypothesis. It's a better mental framework than thinking about efficiency, because I think just the concept of efficiency for a market I find to be nonsensical. It's inapplicable. Markets can't be efficient in the same way that Saturday can't be red. It's just a category error. The efficiency is something you use to describe an engine. So an engine has an optimal amount of energy that goes into, has a maximum amount of energy that goes into it. You know, it takes in this much fuel, and that fuel contains this much energy. There is an efficiency because the amount of energy you get out of the engine is going to be a fraction of the amount of energy that you put in. Every engine, there's no perfect engine. So every engine involves loss. So that's why it makes sense to think about it in terms of efficiency. But if you think of a market in terms of efficiency, you're essentially assuming that there is a maximum, there is an optimum for this market. And that is built on the assumption that there is an optimal way of organizing society. Well, optimal to who? And of course, that's, you know, that's the underlying assumption, is that there's a central planner who's making decisions so that it is optimal for others. And so you get back to the idea that you can perform economic calculation from a central body for everybody else. And that's the fundamental tenet of disagreement between mainstream economists and Austrian economists on the socialist calculation debate. So this is a very long roundabout way of getting back to the hype cycle issue. I think the hype cycle issue shows us just the knowledge of Bitcoin spreading and the information dissipating in the market. And it's the process of people learning how to accept, how to use Bitcoin, how to hold Bitcoin. And more importantly, you know, there's the kind of adoption aspect in a tech sense, you know, the tech adoption of figuring out your private keys and figuring out how you're going to buy and how you're going to keep your Bitcoin safe. But I think even more significant is the liquidity adoption aspect of it, which is making room on your balance sheet for Bitcoin. You know, you usually don't keep a lot of cash in hand, and you have your money spread out over all sorts of things. And then having the conviction to take out money from, say, your saving account or from your stocks or from your bonds, and then putting it into Bitcoin, it's going to take time for people to be able to do it. Even if they achieve the, you know, the conviction about, I understand this thing, I know how to hold it, I know how to do it, they have bills to pay. They have financial obligations in their local fiat and they need to meet them, and they have their salaries coming in. And you need to start making room in your balance sheet, in your savings, without compromising your ability to meet your financial obligations. And of course, if you do that, which many people do in Bitcoin, where, you know, you go all in and you forget about your rent, and then end of the month, you remember you have to pay rent. So then you sell Bitcoin at a loss. If you do that, you know, you could get wrecked. You could lose money because you're not doing the correct liquidity calculation. So it takes time for people to really get into Bitcoin completely, and for balance sheets to go in. Just, I like to think of it as just, you know, the building of the Bitcoin part of the balance sheet. It's not a, even though you can do it with a press of a button, you know, send everything to your Bitcoin dealer and just get Bitcoin for it. In practical terms, you can't really do it. You have balance sheet considerations and you have payments. So I think that, you know, you have the knowledge and the awareness and the ability to adopt an increasing size of your balance sheet in Bitcoin, we are going from 0 to 100% effectively. The journey of Bitcoin is to go from 0%. You know, 2008, Bitcoin owned exactly 0% of the world's cash balances. Who knows when it's going to be 100% or if it's going to be 100%, but let's think of that as the objective. It's only natural that we're going to be witnessing these things go gradually, and it's going to grow at an increasing rate because, you know, it spreads virally, and then each person who gets in can produce more content, can communicate to more people, and then that creates more people in the kind of viral transmission of the idea. So it can increase exponentially in terms of size. But I think perhaps thinking about it in terms of the market actors, I think it makes sense that you would get these hype cycles, particularly when you combine the market actors with the way that the Bitcoin supply works. And so, like, the individual hype cycles that you see around particular technologies, you know, usually, let's say it's the VCR or the DVD or the iPhone, there is that big hype, and then there is a crash, and then the demand stabilizes around, or, you know, the valuation stabilizes around a certain level. But then there comes a point where the thing matures. You know, you have that big parabolic rise in adoption, in market capitalization, in profitability. It may overshoot, but then eventually it stabilizes at a level that is kind of sane. And then that's it. You know, each industry will have, it'll do its 10x, it'll do its 100x, and then it'll get to a level where it settles down. But Bitcoin has had, you know, four or five of these. It's gone through 7-8 orders of magnitudes, from less than a cent to more than $60,000 in the space of 12 years. So I think the reason that we get these repetitive cycles in the case of Bitcoin probably has to do with the supply. It probably has to do with the way that the supply is being generated. In that, the way that I see it is that with each level of production, you know, we started off with 50 new Bitcoins as a block reward, which meant 7,200 Bitcoins a day. At that kind of level, the value of Bitcoin that was outstanding, the value of stockpiles of Bitcoin, you know, the stockpile of Bitcoin out there, its value is always going to be pretty small compared to the inflation. So there's just very little limit on how much adoption can actually happen. So it's not just that it was a small number of people because it was a small little project on the internet that only appealed for a small bunch of weirdos. It, more than that, Bitcoin couldn't really handle a lot of wealth at that point, because if a lot of real money had gone in, the price would have gone up so much that the inflation would have gone up. You know, the new supply, the new 7,200 coins would have been worth so much that it would have brought that wealth crashing down. And eventually that's what happens. So because the value of the production keeps rising as the price rises, that inevitably has a negative feedback loop on the price. And so that's why I think, you know, you get that hype cycle. So you get that big adoption and growth, but the Bitcoin supply, Bitcoin basically becomes more inflationary as the price goes up, because you're getting more real market value in terms of the new Bitcoin that are being produced. So yes, you're still getting the same 7,200 Bitcoins, but they're worth a lot more if Bitcoin is worth $1,000 than if Bitcoin is worth a dollar. So you're going from $7,200 of new Bitcoin a day to $7.2 million of Bitcoin being produced a day. So a thousandfold increase in real market value, which means, you know, you need more hodlers coming in. So I think this is why, you know, we get that crash after there's a big hype and people start catching on. The price rises, the value of the new production rises as well. Eventually, the increase in the price overtakes the ability of new people to come in and keep pumping the price up. In other words, the value of the new production increases the value of new buyers, and then it begins to crash. And then with the leverage, you witness the big crash, and then effectively, you know, we consolidate around a certain level. But then what triggers another hype cycle is the next halving, because then the 7,200 dropped to 3,600, and, you know, we'd already established the price of where, you know, we're able to handle this new price, which was like before the first halving, it was around $10 or so. So the price of Bitcoin was around $10 before the first halving. That was a price where, you know, new demand could handle 7,200 coins a day. So then when you drop the number of coins by half, well, then you're going to allow the existing demand is going to pump the price higher, and that's going to start the hype cycle again. And the price is going to keep shooting up until it overwhelms the new inflation becomes so valuable then it overwhelms the new demand that is coming in. You get the big crash again. I've gone on for way too long, but this is something that I find extremely fascinating, because the crazy thing about Bitcoin is that it's the first commodity or asset on a market that whose supply is extremely accurately well known and everybody can estimate it. So we can see those market trends play out, even if most market participants don't know them. It's a little bit different in that, you know, whether people know it or not, there's the price rising is going to affect the quantity of Bitcoin that is being put out every day, or the value of the Bitcoins that are being put out every day. The quantity is going to stay the same, but the market value is going to be affected. And so that's going to necessarily affect the market for it, I think.
Yeah, so you said a couple of things that I think are really interesting, and I completely agree with. I think the idea that knowledge permeates instantly to all people is as naive as the idea that inflation happens uniformly, that when, you know, when the central bank creates new money, suddenly everyone, this is a model that classical economists often use, that inflation just rises all prices at the same time. But we know about the Cantillon effect, where money gets, the people who get it first have the greatest benefit in their purchasing power, and then it sort of flows out into the economy. And I think you're exactly right. The same thing is true of information. I think that's something that we're understanding with Bitcoin, that, you know, information may travel very fast around the world, but understanding and appreciation of that information is lumpy, and it happens in sort of stages. And it reminds me a little bit of this essay written by Friedrich Hayek, the Use of Knowledge in Society. And he talked about how, you know, central planning, his argument was slightly different to Mises. I think Mises had the stronger argument, but Hayek had some interesting points about how central planning can't work because information is distributed in society, and there are special pockets of information. If you're running a factory, you may have particular knowledge of how that particular factory runs that is never known. It's just part of the process of running the factory. You learn these things that could never be known by a central planner. What you're saying really reminds me of that essay by Hayek. And I completely agree with you. I think the causal factor for these hype cycles is the halving. And, you know, Bitcoin's halving and difficulty adjustment is what's controlling these or triggering these hype cycles. And I write about this in some detail in my book, where I explain in a sort of similar way to you how once Bitcoin crashes and it comes to a new plateau, there's a sort of certain amount of demand which keeps it at that plateau. And halving is a supply shock. When the amount of supply that can be supported by the market is halved, the demand is excess over the supply, and that starts to push the price up. And that pushing of the price up begins the hype cycle, and eventually it gets into this speculative mania again, and it goes beyond what the market can support. Because just as you're saying, once the price of Bitcoin gets high enough, you have to have new demand which can support what the miners are putting onto the market. There's also an interesting dynamic with miners as well, because they're trying to anticipate where the price is going. And as one of these hype cycles starts, a lot of miners will hold back the supply that they've mined. And part of what I think causes the climax, the final climax, is miners starting to dump what they've held and also deciding that they're going to be selling the coins that they've mined, which will bring the price back down to a level which can be supported by demand and bring in a new plateau. But I completely agree with you that these are ultimately tied to Bitcoin's halvings as supply shock events which trigger these hype cycles.
Yeah, and I think this is ultimately what the stock-to-flow model is saying. It's saying that these halving cycles are significant to the price formation. And I think people get too caught up on the math, because the world is so full of bad math that they expect all math to be bad. You know, you look at most scientific studies that get quoted in the media on whatever scientific issue, you know, there's just a bunch of scary math and then we're all going to die. So it's very useful to be skeptical of numerical models in general. But I think what people miss is that every time you think about what Bitcoin is going to be doing in the future, every time you act in a market on what Bitcoin is going to be doing in the future, you are developing a model. And, you know, the most basic model is number go up. And that seems to be doing an extremely good job, which is saying basically over a horizon of 3 years, numbers going to go up. And that basically has never happened. There's never been a day where the Bitcoin price was lower than where it was 3 years ago. I think maybe that's maybe 3 years and a couple of months is the longest we'll find. This has never happened. So, you know, that ultimately is the bullish case for Bitcoin, and that number is going to go up. So you buy it because you think you're going to be able to exchange it for more things. The number of things that you can get for it in the future goes up. You can think of that qualitatively as just it's going to go up. And then you can try and model it by trying to estimate based on past performance what you would think the magnitude of this going up is going to be. And here, you know, you would expect it not to be very accurate. But if you just looked at, you know, time, you made a relationship between the price and time, you're going to get a statistical relationship and you can extrapolate it. You can make predictions on the future. So that's what kind of the rainbow model is. It's just a time model where you're looking at the price every day and then extrapolating and making error bands around it. And the difference between that and the stock to flow is that the stock to flow is like a time model in many ways. Because the stock to flow rises as time goes on. So it's very similar to it, but it is different in one very important way, which is that the stock to flow doubles every 4 years. It has that jump every 4 years. So if you find that the stock to flow model is better at explaining the variation in Bitcoin prices than a static price model, then I think what that's saying, you know, the signal there is that the halvings matter for price formation. I think it's very hard to look at Bitcoin seriously and think that the halving doesn't matter. You have to have spent a lot of time getting miseducated in bad mainstream economics in order to think, no, the halving doesn't actually matter because it's knowledge that is out there. Well, no, it's not knowledge that's out there. The vast majority of people in the world have no idea what Bitcoin is. Among the minority that have heard of Bitcoin, a majority don't understand it properly. Don't think it matters to them, and don't think that it is relevant. They think it's just this weird new thing that weird people are using, like, you know, Ethereum or some shitcoin. The vast majority of people still don't really get what is going on here. So for the vast majority of people, the knowledge of the halving is inexistent. Amongst the people who know about Bitcoin, only a small minority know about the halving. And then among the minority that know, among the people who know about the halving, I think a significant chunk, maybe not a majority, has had its economic reasoning compromised by mainstream education's take on these questions, where they just think, oh, okay, we know about the halving, but obviously everybody else knows about the halving, and so it doesn't matter. Well, no, 99.9% of the world's wealth, well, maybe not 99, probably 90% of the world's wealth doesn't know what the halving, at least, I'd say. Doesn't know what the halving is and doesn't think that it has an impact on the price. And so whether they do or don't also, you know, it's one thing to know. This is the other thing that I think people miss, is that it's one thing that people know about the halving. It's a completely other thing whether their knowledge is actually going to matter. In order to do that, they need to take resources out of one thing and deploy it into, you know, pricing in the halving. So it's not enough to just say, oh, well, I know that the halving is going to happen. You need people to actually think, all right, I'm going to sell my house or my stocks or do this and buy some Bitcoin now in order to sell it 6 months after the halving, because I think the halving is going to do that, is going to cause the price to rise. And so here, you know, not only are we talking about a small minority of within a small minority, but also you have their own liquidity constraints. You know, these people have bills to pay and they have other things to own. Some of them have chairs they want to keep. And so there's a limit to how much capital they can bring into arbitraging this. And so, you know, that's why people have been shouting that the halving makes number go up for 6-7 years now. And you still could have traded the halving both times and done really well. So we're now...
I see you have a chair, Saif. You're sitting on a chair. So maybe the understanding is not fully, you know, embedded in your mind. You see, I don't have a chair, so that I fully appreciated the significance of the halving.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of us LARP about understanding the economics of Bitcoin, but we don't spend money on a chair. Knowledge is incomplete, and conviction. I'd say, yeah, knowledge is incomplete, and conviction is also lacking. And in order for people to start pricing it in, I think you need more conviction. And with each halving, I think that's going to increase. Because if you look at it, I mean, it's basically been a very, very lucrative trade in every example, which is, buy 6 months before the halving and sell 6 months after the halving. So let's think, what was it 6 months before the halving last year? It was December 2018. Bitcoin was around 3 or 4,000. And then 6 months after the halving was November 2020 or December 2020 or something like that. Bitcoin was around 20,000. So it was all just an eightfold appreciation or fivefold appreciation in just the matter of 1 year. It's hard to believe that there are, people don't like to believe that there are dollars on the sidewalk, but sometimes there are dollars on the sidewalk, and if you don't pick them up, somebody else will, but they won't be there for long. But they will be there. In fact, dollars fall on sidewalks all the time, but they just get picked up quickly. I think another
You
example.
said, could I just say something about the, I think you said something that I think is really important, but not very well understood. And I think conviction itself is almost a form of understanding. And it's talk is cheap in markets. And a lot of people talk and say, I think this will happen or that will happen. But really, that's not true understanding. True understanding only comes with the willingness to deploy capital. That's when you believe that in what you're saying, because you can utter words out of your mouth that you have no real belief in. And I like to think of the example of the great debate about what Bitcoin should be and the fork and the split of the network in 2017. There are a lot of people who said this new version of Bitcoin, the SegWit 2x, is the real Bitcoin, and we believe it's going to be new Bitcoin, and all these miners are going to mine this new chain, and the legacy chain is going to die. One of the things which made me realize very early on that this was absolutely not going to happen was I challenged these people directly. I said, hey, Eric, Eric Voorhees or Mike Belshi or these people, okay, you believe that, but I believe something different, and I'm willing to trade with you. I will give you all of my 2x tokens that I get for free when this split happens for all of your Bitcoin. Not a single one of them were willing to trade with me. So I think it's really important to understand that conviction itself is a part of knowledge. And when people say things, we don't know whether they really believe it or not. It's when they act. It is the human action which matters. And when the conviction is manifested in deployment of capital, that's when it really matters. So I just wanted to highlight that point I thought you made. It was really important.
Absolutely. I think this is this is another difference in the approach between the Austrians and the mainstreamers, in that in mainstream theories, if you have the knowledge in your equation on the software that you're using to model the economy with your general equilibrium models, if you add in the fact that, oh well, now people know that say there was a fire at the shoe factory, well now shoe prices are going to rise. Yeah, I mean, you add it into your equation and you click calculate, and within a few seconds, you come up with the result that people have adjusted. But in the real world, people have to actually act upon it. And that's not effortless, that's not costless, that requires knowledge and requires conviction. I think, one example that I like to give for this, which I used to use when I used to teach, is Chicago economist, I think I've heard some time mentioning that when they go to the supermarket, they don't care about finding the shortest line because they believe the market will have already, there's no difference. People are always looking out for the shortest line. And so all the supermarket lines are expected to have the same weight. And in my mind, this is exactly the problem with efficient market hypothesis. The only reason that the lines end up being roughly equal, of course, they're never equal. You can't make them perfectly equal. Nobody knows how much time each shopper is going to do. But the only reason they tend to be equal is that every single shopper looks around and looks at all the lines and tries to make their best guess about which one is going to be shortest. And then they line up at the one that they think is going to take the least time. And so if everybody believed in the efficient market hypothesis, nobody would look, and everybody would be acting like the Chicago economist and just lining up behind the same line. And, you know, you're going to end up with lines that are empty for a very long time and lines that are extremely crowded for a very long time because people are picking randomly. And, you know, if you do it randomly, you're going to get concentrations in one. You know, aisle five will have 20 people and aisle six will have nobody for a while. It'll happen.
This is why Warren Buffett has said he really loves people who believe in this stuff, because it gives him the opportunity to find these inefficiencies. Like you're saying, if these economists, if everyone believed what these economists said, you have this gigantic line, people just go into the closest line thinking, oh, this is efficient. But that presents the opportunity for people who recognize that this theory is nonsense to act on the inefficiency caused by people believing this stuff. Is it funny? Because Warren Buffett has said the exact same thing. He loves it that people don't think there are any market opportunities, that they should just, you know, buy the entire market because they have no information or no knowledge. Perhaps in some cases, some people don't have any information or knowledge and they should just stay out of the market. But there clearly are opportunities. If there is an information asymmetry, you know something or you understand something better than someone else.
It's also just almost a nihilistic way of looking at the world where, you know, nothing you know matters because people have already known it. If it's true, then everybody knows it and you shouldn't act upon it. And if it's not true, then nobody should act upon it and it's wrong and you shouldn't act upon it. And this is why a lot of economists and business school professors are out there teaching about investing. The majority of them don't invest, don't manage their investments. They just put their money in their university retirement account and then they have others manage it. So, you know, they're constantly making these theories, telling people that basically there's no value for judgment and there's no value for knowledge. Maybe it's just projection. Maybe there's no value for your judgment and your knowledge, and maybe you should stay out of the market. But you know what? Real people who actually work in the real world, you know, people who have actual jobs, they all have some knowledge. You know, you might not know enough about the world market to be able to go and pick the right stocks and hedge properly and to have the correct allocation of the portfolio between different stocks and commodities and bonds and all of that stuff. But you have a business in which you work in, and you know, for instance, you work in fast food and you know that our company is getting its ass kicked. The other company is doing much better. Perhaps I should buy some of the stock of the other company. That's very valuable knowledge, which people who don't work in your fast food industry don't have. And so everybody has that knowledge. And it's almost like the difference between being depressed about life and being nihilistic and thinking that nothing you know matters, and therefore, you know, you just trudge along from your job and get your
paycheck. Well, it's a form of determinism, isn't it? I mean, it's almost denying free will. It's determinism. I've always found that people who believe in determinism tend to be very nihilistic about the world. Why do anything? Why believe in anything if it's all predetermined? So to me, it's almost like an economic manifestation of this mindset that we have no control, it's all predetermined. If you believe that, you wouldn't do anything.
Absolutely. And that's why a lot of these people don't do anything. You know, you can see this, incidentally, this helps us understand another layer of no-coiners, in that if you think like that, if you think the market is all-knowing and everybody knows everything that has ever happened, then in your mind, nothing new can come along. You know, we can have small cosmetic differences. We'll witness the computer go from one big giant building into a little machine in your hand over 50, 60 years, but you can't mentally take the idea that we're going to go from a world with no computers to computers. You know, a lot of those people would have struggled. And a lot of people did struggle with computers. You know, they died and never used computers, and they died thinking computers were weird little distractions that people will outgrow. If you think in this way, I think it's highly conducive to it. And it's, especially when it comes to government money, where none of those people has ever imagined that anything could challenge the sacred position of government money. And yet, you know, if you look at it with fresh eyes, with reason, like many people from all over the world have, you see that there's a very compelling case for why people are going to figure out that Bitcoin is better and why Bitcoin is going to prove itself better on the market and why it's going to continue to rise and why it's probably better for you to stop being a negative, bitter nihilist and start stacking some sats.
Well, there's an interesting Austrian insight that I've always been fascinated with, which is that to act itself requires the presupposition that the action can affect the world. So the people who are saying, you know, they believe in determinism or whatever, that they have this inherent assumption prior to the action of saying that they are able to do something or to say something or to utter the thought or to, you know, give voice to what they believe. So they're almost contradicting themselves in a way. They're presupposing that they have the power to act, to say something, which is denying the thing that they're saying, that the world is predetermined. So I've always found that an interesting insight. I think maybe it was Hopper or, you know, one of these Austrians who used this, that when we act, there are certain presuppositions we make that are inherent to our action. And what, you know, logical deductions can we make from those presuppositions? And that's one of them. It's very contradictory, almost self-contradictory to say that the world is predetermined because you are assuming something when you say that.
I think this is just beginning to occur to me right now, but there's definitely something in the fiat mentality that militates you toward having an impotent view of the world, a view of a spectator, where you're just a TV viewer, where passively receiving what the world is doing. I think, you know, I look back to many of my colleagues in Lebanon who have heard me talk about Bitcoin in our university for many years now. You know, it's been a few years of me talking about Bitcoin and years of them just giggling about this weirdo talking about this weird internet thing. You can explain the technical aspects. You can explain the economics of it. You can explain the bullish case for it. You can give them the Bitcoin standard. You can give them the bullish case for Bitcoin. And they could even read it, but there's an element of there's a switch that just doesn't click, wherein, okay, so I can actually act myself and fix my own life with this thing. Like, okay, that switch just doesn't exist in the mind of many academics. In the sense, it's just, okay, so, well, this interesting thing is there. Well, you know, if it gets approved, then we'll all be using it. Until then, you know, stop wasting my time talking about your stupid magic internet money, you know. It's like this, somebody needs to flick the switch of action for you because you're just a TV viewer. So, you know, if they're going to put that show on TV, then I'll watch it. But, you know, for now, I just need to get back to watching my current show that is on the TV. I think really fiat education militates for this kind of mentality because, you know, think about fiat education. It's completely debauched the scientific process, where it's not, the scientific process is not about asking questions. It's not a method for knowing how the world works. Under the fiat system, it's a method for finding set answers. You know, how do we explain why the world is like this? Why is the world like this and not like that? And there are answers. Fiat science is answers. Fiat economics is answers. If you have a recession, if you have unemployment, you fix that by doing 1, 2, 3. It's all about finding set answers because, you know, somebody's going to have to determine who gets funding, and that person has to have an objective idea of what is the correct answer. What is the correct physics? What is the correct chemistry? What is the correct biology? What is the correct nutrition? And Bitcoin really breaks these mental shackles in people who accept it, you know. And a lot of people are just not able to make that jump. And it's quite astounding, actually. You said something earlier. You were saying, this is why this example occurred to me. You were saying how you can see how people in developing countries could be more likely to see the value proposition in Bitcoin because their currencies are being destroyed by inflation. I'm beginning to realize over the last few weeks, there's a very, very, very powerful and very malignant strain of Bitcoin derangement syndrome that is triggered by being in an inflation, wherein it becomes, it's not just that you'd refuse to get into Bitcoin, that it becomes a matter of personal pride that you need to make sure that the world knows that Bitcoin is bad. And I think the prime example of this is Nassim Taleb, who's just on this insane crusade at this point to, I don't know what he's trying to prove. Basically, Bitcoin is bad and Bitcoin is not good and it's not a major technology. He doesn't really have any coherent idea. Like, again, it's a fiat mind that's just out there issuing proclamations that, you know, Bitcoin is not good and it doesn't work and shouldn't work. Well, it's out there and it's working. And you think about, you know, the level of derangement, I'm beginning to be convinced that a big part of that is just he is psychologically unable to handle the load of thinking about the implication of the fact that Bitcoin has been there for 12 years now. And anybody in Lebanon over the last 12 years who had considered Bitcoin and had put some money into Bitcoin had basically saved themselves from the financial collapse that has destroyed the Lebanese economy. It's one of the worst collapses that the world has seen in the last century or so, the World Bank was saying a few days ago. So it's been completely devastating. It spared nobody because businesses have been destroyed. The currency is continuing to get destroyed. It's lost 90% in 2 years, and it shows no signs of stopping. Everything is falling apart in the country. The infrastructure is falling apart. Everything is terrible. And just think about how much better life would have been for people there if they had accepted, if they had started adopting Bitcoin earlier. And now it's at the point where, you know, admitting that Bitcoin could have made things better means that you were a massive idiot a couple of years ago for not thinking about Bitcoin. And so now it's important to double down. And, you know, it's astounding. It's absolutely amazing. You know, the use of Bitcoin in Lebanon is spreading widely. You know, people are getting into it, but it's real normal people. It's not academics who are getting into it. Academics are still having their seminars discussing, you know, how do we reform the banking system and how do we reform the political process, and all of these university professors coming up with political reform. And it's so pathetic that, you know, the Lebanese state is so transparent about the fact that they're just a bunch of mafias and bunch of militias that are out there to rob the people of the country. It's so blatant, it's so obvious, and it's so pathetic that you go to those people and you tell them, hey, I've figured out a way for you to stop robbing us and make us stop losing our wealth. Could you please implement these reforms that I'm asking for? This is the level of discourse in most fiat minds. This is what university professors are doing. This is what the intellectuals are doing in Lebanon because they can't snap out of this. And it's devastating that so many people put weight on the words of these people because they're out there unable to see that, look, there's a lifeboat that's just, it's a spaceship and a lifeboat that's just waiting for you, and you can just get in at any point in time, and all you need to do is just go in there. And nope, they're sitting there and listening to Nassim Taleb pontificate about why it's not going to work, and it's it's
well, these intellectuals will be last in line for adoption because I think psychologically their identity is so tied to this system that they support and they get their power from. You know, they in a true free market where they don't have any largesse coming from the state, you know, people like Paul Krugman, their opinions have no value. No one cares about them. They, you know, I think you made a funny comment when we were on stage in Miami that he would be an elementary school teacher or something like that. And, you know, you talked about Taleb sort of switching to, you know, saying Bitcoin is going to die or whatever. I think, you know, when someone predicts a fire successfully, you have to wonder whether they're, you know, a good prognosticator or they're just an arson. Are they someone who, you know, started the fire themselves and predicted it? And I think some of these intellectuals, not only are they content with dismissing Bitcoin, they actively are trying to destroy it. They're trying to call upon the state to destroy it because they see that its success is a real threat to their identity and their credibility. And so that they're not merely content to try and understand it as an intellectual endeavor. They want to actively destroy it. And they're out there trying to do that with their words. They're trying to convince people that this isn't the lifeboat as you say it is and you recognize it. So I have very low opinion of these people. They're not merely interested in understanding the world or interested in understanding this new phenomena, even if they don't fully understand the technology or whatever. That would, to me, someone who had the curiosity to say, like, I'm just trying to understand this. I want to understand this is new. Clearly, it doesn't fit within the models I have. I'm willing to come to this as a student. They're not willing to do that. They have their identity tied to the current system, to the status quo. And any threat to that status quo is reason for them to attack the new thing. So I have very low opinion of people like Krugman and Rubini. I think they're the kind of people who don't speak truth to power. They speak power to truth. They're the mouthpiece of the state, and they're really inherently evil for doing that, being the mouthpiece of the power apparatus. I think it's completely disgusting.
Yeah, honestly, I think the last few weeks is when I've started to really switch from just thinking of these people as inconsequential idiots into truly despising them as being despicable criminals, effectively, almost. Because it's, you know, you think about somebody like Talib in Lebanon. I mean, just he's got an enormous following of morons who hang by his every word. You know, a lot of people going around and trying all kinds of industrial shit pasta in order to stick with his prognostications and trying all kinds of weird things because he talks about it. Just think about all of those people, you know, how different their life would have been if this world expert on risk who has predicted everything that has ever happened in financial markets by his own admission, by his own estimation, even though, you know, he's never shared his records. If this guy had been telling his cult to get into Bitcoin, you know, 1% allocation of Bitcoin for somebody in Lebanon, a 1% allocation in June 2019, so 2 years ago. It was exactly 2 years ago when the problem started in Lebanon. It's July when the problems, when the lira decoupled from the dollar and then everything began to collapse. If you had a 1% allocation to Bitcoin in June 2019, that allocation today, if you had 99% in lira and 1% in Bitcoin, today you would have 99% in Bitcoin and 1% in lira without doing any rebalancing. Bitcoin has appreciated in dollar terms over those 2 years. It's appreciated about 4 or 5 fold, whereas the lira has dropped to 10% of its value. So, you know, you run the numbers and basically Bitcoin ends up being, you end up, I ran the numbers on this roughly. You needed a 1% allocation in Bitcoin in July 2019 in order to basically have lost no wealth today compared to what would have happened. Maybe it's a little bit more than 1%. Actually, no, it wouldn't. Forget the exact numbers, but yeah, as 1%. 1% hedge would have been an enormous, enormous, enormous help for anybody. And to think
and I was just going to say, it's this great, great, great irony that the guy who wrote the book, The Black Swan, has the greatest financial black swan right in front of his face, and he can't see it.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And it's, you know, you can laugh at him, but I think that it's truly tragic. I mean, how many people out there are not getting into Bitcoin because they look at this guy and he seems like he knows what he's talking about because he has that sure attitude. And people are giving up on the lifeboat and they're continuing to hold on to their liras. And of course, he is a statist in many ways, but he's also buddies with people in the Lebanese government. So his mental model is still that, you know, the Lebanese government is going to, you know, if only they'd listen to him and do what he says, then they could fix the banking system and fix the currency and get everything back on order. And it's just, it's so pathetically naive. But you can't just excuse the naivety because it's actively harmful. He's turning people away from something that could actually save them. And the currency is just continuing to collapse. It's unconscionable, really.
Yeah, I agree. And he has this role as an educator, and I feel like we have this role as well. We're sort of thrust into the role of educators. I never imagined I'd be explaining things to people or going on podcasts or whatever. But I take that very seriously. The consequences to the people who listen to me really matter to me. As Bitcoiners, I think we really care about the world being a better place. And I think it definitely is always important as someone who is being listened to, who has an audience, to think about what people take from your words and whether it benefits them or it harms them.
We've gone on for longer than usual, you and I. It's time to let others ask questions. Spencer has a question he wanted to ask you. Spencer.
Could I ask could I ask you your question first, Saif?
Sure, go ahead.
There's a couple of topics that we haven't talked about, and one of the things that I would love to hear your opinion on. I mean, you can be as brief as you want, but one of the things I don't think I fully anticipated when I started thinking about Bitcoin and started to understand, the evolution of money and people using it as a store of value before it, transitions to being a medium of exchange, is Bitcoin's use as a collateral asset. That's something which I think I've learned and I've recognized. This is an incredibly powerful form of collateral. And I can see that as one of the sort of driving forces of Bitcoin becoming the monetary base of the world, is these financial institutions recognizing this. Hey, this is an amazing form of collateral. We can build all sorts of financial products on top of this. You post some Bitcoin as collateral, and we'll provide all sorts of derivative products that let you bet on anything. You can be someone in Bangladesh, and you have some Bitcoin, you can bet on the US stock market. That's an incredibly important development, I think, and an interesting development. And I think you recognize this pretty early on, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that development.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin makes a lot of sense as collateral because it's an asset that doesn't have third-party liabilities and doesn't need somebody to continue to make payments. It doesn't need revenues in order for it to continue to function. So in that sense, it's like gold, and gold does a great job as collateral. You keep it with somebody, and then they can be sure that they have something. And its value is not limited to anybody else making performing things. The interesting thing is whether this is similar to the question that we were discussing earlier in terms of Bitcoin coexisting with national currencies. It's interesting to think whether Bitcoin can stick to just staying as collateral while other monies get used. And I think there is perhaps a case to be made, the Michael Saylor idea that you just continue to borrow against your Bitcoin. And people just borrow against their Bitcoin. So you can imagine, if the fiat coins continue to survive, then why would anybody want to spend their Bitcoins? People who have Bitcoin will just collateralize them and borrow against them and spend from them. And, Bitcoin appreciates so much that if you keep your spending within a certain limit, if you spend less than the appreciation, then you don't lose any Bitcoin. So you just keep the same stack of, you could go through your whole life living off of a Bitcoin stack handed to you without selling a single Satoshi. But I don't see how that can survive, because if everybody does that, who's going to be paying the interest rate for it? I think eventually we get to a point where everybody wants to do that, and then there's no more fiat to borrow against, and then you can't really use it as collateral because nobody wants to take the fiat. Everybody wants to hold the Bitcoin. That's the way that I see
It,
it.
it yeah, but I think it's an interesting driver for adoption, is financial institutions saying this is a really great form of collateral for us to provide products on top of. And gold is a great form of collateral too, because it's a bearer instrument. When you have the thing, it's valuable in and of itself. It's not a, like you say, not a liability. But Bitcoin is so far superior to gold as a collateral asset because of its transmissibility and the ease with which you can custody it. Financial institutions can fairly easily roll out a node and start accepting Bitcoin and be accepting large amounts of collateral that way and building services on top of that. Whereas with gold, it's kind of a pain, right? Are people going to post gold in the US mail to you? Are you going to build a storage vault or whatever? It's certainly much more difficult. So I'm fascinated with Bitcoin's growing use and the services that are being provided. I mean, it's just still very early. Like the companies that are doing this, Genesis and BlockFi, are giving you a very small inkling of what's possible. But I think we're going to see all sorts of products built on top of this in the future, where people all around the world can make bets on any kind of market just because they have Bitcoin. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating. And it's not something that you would have predicted easily earlier, but it's developed. It's amazing, you know, business and the markets develop in ways that, you know, it takes one visionary to do something. And then if it works, everybody finds out about it. Then the knowledge spreads. But you had another question you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I had another question, but I can take questions. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the book you're writing, and sort of because you helped me, you guided me to this sort of going and self-publishing. And I think there's a lot of interesting thoughts on that. For I think many more people or authors in the space are going to sort of move in that direction. And I'd love to just chat with you about that, because I think that's interesting for other educators in the space who want to get their ideas out there and do that in the most effective way, both for their audience and for themselves. But we can leave that till later on if we have time.
I guess I'll just cover some of the main ideas. I published the Bitcoin Standard with an academic publisher, and part of the motivation then was that I was an academic and I thought getting academic publications was important because it'll help me keep my job. But then, thankfully, I later decided that the academic job is just not something that I want to be doing. So it was an expensive mistake in retrospect, because they end up taking a lot of the rights. And in my case, you know, it's not like the publisher had a big role to play with the book. I'd already written the book and then I sent it to the publisher and they just had to print it and take a big commission of it. But that's, you know, that's the system of slavery that is academic publication, and which I discuss in the Fiat Standard. And so appropriately enough, you know, I'm not presenting it to any publisher, even though my publisher for the Bitcoin Standard wanted to publish the Fiat Standard. They made me an offer for it, but it really makes no sense. So they do pay you in advance, but they take a big chunk of the returns on the book, and it really doesn't make sense, because they're highly inefficient compared to what's happening. And the reason they can get away with the inefficiency is that they have a practical monopoly position. There's a few mega corporations that are publishing in the publishing industry that are in the academic publication, specifically in the academic publication industry. The reason that they continue to make a lot of money is that you need to get your papers from them. And you need to get your papers published with them in order to keep your job at a university. And so fiat science functions by money assignment from above. So government committees decide which department gets how much money and which universities will get funding and which projects get funding and which research grants get approved. And so in order to impress those people, what you need to do is you need to get publications in these academic journals. And so a guy by the name of Robert Maxwell, who happens to be Ghislaine Maxwell's father, I always like to bring this up, he made a huge leap in the publication industry by getting the universities to adopt the publication in the academic publication industry as the standard for promotion and for assessing work in academia. And so with that, he basically managed to capture a lot of the rents that come to universities. So a lot of the money that is made from the education system goes to the academic publishers, who do nothing. I mean, let's be clear about it. All that they do is that they have titles to the journals that you need to publish in order to get into to keep your job. So what they do is they'll get academics to write for them, they'll get academics to edit for them, and they'll get all the work done for free. They'll then publish the journal and then they'll sell it at exorbitant prices back to the academic same university. So it's a big giant corrupt mess, and it's all financed by fiat money, by government money coming in from above. And it works for the publishers greatly. It works for the administrators of the university who are friendly with the publishers and who keep the system going. And it ends up being a bunch of, it ends up turning academics into a bunch of slaves that are making, you know, make work papers that produce nothing of value, but, you know, they tick the boxes of the academic journals. And so this is why most academic papers are unreadable. It's just people filling quotas. It's industrial production of Chomsky sentences, as Alan and I were saying in the earlier podcast, Alan Farrington. It's just a bunch of sentences that are grammatically and politically correct, but reading them doesn't benefit you in any way. So all of that is to say that the publication industry is not a very good place for authors, particularly academic publishers. And I think right now, you know, what the internet allows us, it's what's hugely disruptive is the model of self-publishing, because you can do a lot of the things that you that your publisher does for you, and there's not a lot of things that the publisher does. You can do them yourself, or you could hire people to do them. There are specialized services that that will help you self-publish. And so that's what I'm going with the Fiat standard. And that's why I also did the Kickstarter, as you have done. You did your Kickstarter for the bullish case for Bitcoin, and I'm doing one for the Fiat standard, which I think makes much more sense. Rather than getting an advance from the publisher, get the advance from the readers directly. So people can buy the copies in advance, and they can get access to the draft as it is being written. And that's what I'm going with. Hopefully, I'm going to have the book out by December, the Fiat standard.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. And one thing that I learned is, you know, when I started working on the book, is that if you go with a publisher and you sell a book for $20, you might be lucky to get $1 or $1.50 out of that. If you self-publish and you go through retailers, then you might get $5 or $6 out of 20. But if you use something like Kickstarter, it's great because you're selling directly to your audience. And, you know, I'm excited because I got to buy your book directly from you, and I got to get the signed copy as well, which I'm excited about. And that's cool because you're getting most of that. You'll probably get 90 to 95% of that minus the cost of production and shipping, which is much more remunerative to you. And I'm hopeful that, you know, other people who are creating books in the Bitcoin space are going to go down this same path that we've both chosen to go down, because it takes power away from this printing establishment and it connects you directly to your audience. And I think for most people, it's going to get much more money into their pockets as well, which I think for people who are educating, who are doing that as kind of their profession, that's important.
Yeah, and another very important point about self-publishing is that you own the rights for the book, and then you can do whatever you want with the book, which is actually, this is probably the biggest problem that I have with the fiat standard, with the Bitcoin standard, is that it's very difficult to get the publisher to sign off on all kinds of very interesting projects that I would have done if I owned the rights. So I'd happily, you know, sell a company, sell a Bitcoin company the right to send the digital copies at a massive discount if they want to buy a big bulk number of copies. The publisher has no interest in getting into things like that. I'd put the book up for free online. I think that would be very good, because a lot of people would read it. A lot of people would share it. The publisher, or, you know, putting excerpts of the book, the publisher is very careful about not wanting to do that. They're much slower for moving on all kinds of things because you're dealing with a big bureaucracy. But if you own the rights, you know, you can do all the interesting projects that you want. You can take excerpts from the book, publish them in a specific format. You can make derivative works, and you're not constrained by them having to make the call. It's your book, and there really is no good reason for somebody else to control the rights of the book and tell you what you can and cannot do with your book.
Yeah, I'm really grateful that you pointed me down that path. I could have easily made the mistake of going the other way, and very early on you pointed me in that direction and gave me some good reasons for that. So I appreciate that.
Well, glad to hear that. All right, let's get to Spencer's question. Spencer.
Thanks, Saif. I was actually reviewing the original article earlier today on the bullish case for Bitcoin. And something that kind of stood out to me, BJ, was the part talking about the entrance of nation states So right after you explain the Gartner hype cycle, you say that the last one will start when nation states start accumulating Bitcoin as part of their currency reserves. And recently, El Salvador had that, passed a law where Bitcoin is now legal tender. And I've heard all sorts of perspectives of it from the community, whether that's a good thing and this is like the best thing that's ever happened to Bitcoin. Some people feel it's a bad thing, the way that it was legislated. How do you feel it's that legislation is going to affect Bitcoin, like as a whole?
Yeah, I think this is a very exciting and a stunning development, to be honest. I predicted this kind of thing happening later on. And it could be the case that El Salvador is just so far ahead of the curve that we won't see many more states doing this for a while. But, you know, I think that the primary benefit here is that Bitcoin can be used without friction in El Salvador. So if you want to use Bitcoin as a medium of exchange in the US, if you've bought some Bitcoin, let's say for $100, and now the value is $500, and you want to spend some of that Bitcoin, you'll be taxed on the difference, on the $400 gain you've made when you spend. And that tax rate in the US is quite high. I mean, Biden wants to get it as high as, I mean, if you include the federal tax, and if you live in, say, California, it could be high as 50% that you're losing on those gains. Whereas in El Salvador, people are going to be able to trade Bitcoin without friction. It's going to be tax-free. And I think that removes a huge impediment to adoption. And I think it will help accelerate adoption. I think it's fantastic for a country where there are, you know, very poor parts of the country which don't have good financial infrastructure. The infrastructure for Bitcoin exists on the internet, so anyone can use it. And if you have an internet connection, so I think this is going to supercharge adoption of Bitcoin in El Salvador. You know, just the marketing of the president saying that we're making it legal tender is going to get people across the entire country interested in it. And I think as adoption grows, I think neighboring countries in Latin America are going to look at El Salvador and recognize that it had a powerful impact on the financial position of their country. And, you know, I think it's probably going to take a few years, but it will not escape the attention of other countries. In my article, I said that the final Gartner hype cycle will happen when nation states start adding Bitcoin to their reserves. El Salvador hasn't really done that. They're not sort of taking a big reserve position in Bitcoin. And my view is that somewhat unfortunately, I think that the nations which will do that first are the sort of dictatorships and kleptocracies, nations like North Korea, perhaps, or Venezuela. And these countries will do it because they will want to have something valuable that can be traded and can't easily be confiscated. And I think, you know, with the example of Venezuela, they tried to repatriate their gold from England, and the British government said, no, you can't have your gold back. It was President Maduro doing that. And, you know, whatever opinion you have on Maduro, I think he's an awful person and I think his policies are awful, but it's a very worrying sign if you're in the position of power for a nation state that you can't even repatriate the savings of your nation back to your nation. So Bitcoin really solves this. And I think smaller nations which feel shut out by the US hegemony over the global financial system will start to look at Bitcoin as something that they want to add to their reserves. You know, El Salvador to me feels like a bit of a curveball. It's really exciting and stunning development to me that a nation state would get involved this early on. And I think it's exciting because it provides an example to other nations, especially in Latin America, that it's beneficial to them and to their people and to their economy to adopt Bitcoin. So, yeah, those are my thoughts. I'm very excited about it.
Regarding Vijay's article, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, in the article, you go through quite a lot of the monetary history and the emergence of gold from collectibles historically. And I just wondered what your take was on the state theory of money in general, because the general case that's put forward in articles that you reference, like Nick Szabo shelling out, has been criticized by people like David Graeber in Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And so I wondered what your take was on that general theory of money and whether you think it's in any way a legitimate theory of money, or do you just think that the kind of standard Austrian framework is a better way of looking at it?
I certainly subscribe to the Austrian view of the emergence of money on the market. And I think the state theory of money doesn't hold up for me for a couple of reasons. Firstly, nation states didn't have this gigantic power going, you know, way back in human history. I mean, you have these very, you know, small tribal societies, nomadic societies, and those going way back in history, people were already using things that sort of proto-money. They were using things which didn't really have, I think the archaeological record shows this in the stuff that Nick Szabo has written about, you know, societies which were using shells and beads and stuff like that when they didn't have like powerful nation states. I also find that sort of debt-based emergence of money that Graeber posits as highly unconvincing. Like I can see debt arrangements working within small high trust societies where people really believe that they're going to get paid back. But I think that doesn't explain how trade happens between societies that don't trust each other or antagonistic to each other. They can't, you're not going to have debt-based arrangements with, you know, rival tribes, but you could potentially trade with them if you have a means of settlement or something that you both mutually value. And I think that really helps to explain how the emergence of gold. It's not an obligation of anyone. It's not like it's not a form of debt. It's just something that's widely recognized as valuable and that people will ultimately want to settle in, and allows trade between people who don't necessarily trust each other at all or are antagonistic. I just don't think you could have, you know, trade between, say, Rome, in ancient Rome and India by a debt arrangement. I just don't think that can work. Trade can only happen through something that's mutually valued between different people who don't really trust each other. So I don't find it convincing at all. And, you know, I know he's put forward those arguments, but I don't see how it explains how trade could have happened. And clearly trade did happen between people in different societies that were either distant from each other or didn't trust each other. How do you explain that? And I don't feel like that Graeber's account is a compelling one to explain that. Perhaps there are debt arrangements that did happen within high trust societies or small societies. I can buy that. But I don't think it explains how something like gold emerged as a medium of settlement between people who are far apart.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think it's a ridiculous it's a ridiculous theory of money, the way that he presents it. Because first of all, as you say, the issue of trust, you can't have debt with people that you don't trust. And you can't have debt with people that you don't expect to be continuously dealing with. So if they're in your family or your neighbors or your tribes, then yeah, I can help you with your harvest now, and then you help me in my harvest 3 months later, and we settle it by me giving you a part of mine and you giving me a part of yours. Okay, these things can happen, of course. We live next to each other. We don't want to antagonize each other, and we're both better off from doing this. But that's not what a market economy is. And it's obvious, yeah, he's a Marxist because he doesn't understand what a market economy is and how it functions. The way that a market economy functions is that it is impersonal trade. You don't have to be friends and family with somebody in order to trade with them. And beyond the scale of a primitive tribe, it's strangers who are trading and who don't want to have a commitment. You know, I want to pay you. I want to give you something, and I want to take the money, and I don't want to have to come back to you for the money. I want to spend it now. So first of all, he misses the fact that, you know, you don't have the trust with others, and markets grow much more than our circles of trust can grow. You know, we trade with people from all over the world, but we can only trust a few people. So there's that problem. And then there's the issue of liquidity, which he misses, I think, which is that debt is just not good money. It's not liquid money. Okay, I trust you, and you promised me you're going to pay me back in something in 6 months. But from now until the 6 months, I can't use that money for anything because that's tied up with you. I would obviously prefer something that I could have the optionality of using in case I needed it. You know, if there's a crisis in the 6 months intervening and you paid me with a form of cash, I could use that cash to get myself out of that crisis. But if you pay me with debt, then there's no benefit from it. So
I think it's it just misses the importance of money on many levels. And then it just assumes that, yeah, well, look, we have examples of people within small settings dealing with each other from debt. And then we just assume this is how debt, this is how money comes along. It's a very, very special case of money that exists between people who are very familiar with each other. And I think in a part of principles of economics, I get into this discussion about is, you know, what is the difference between debt and money? And we can think about debt in the same terms in which we think about Bitcoin and gold and fiat and other kinds of money. You know, if you're going to make debt into money, how does it measure against those things in terms of its salability? Well, it's saleable across time, not very well, because debt can get devalued and people can default. And it's not very saleable across space as well, because the circles of credibility for your debt quickly diminish. You know, your debt is good with me. It's not very good with my neighbor, and it's even less good with their neighbor, you know, or with their friend who doesn't know me or you. So using this as a medium of exchange just puts the people who use it at a severe disadvantage compared to people who use a better money. And so ultimately, in economic logic, that's what matters. If it gives people an advantage, it's going to be used more and more.
Yeah, and in addition to that, there's not really a common unit, is there, for debt? It's a kind of derivative quantity. So in the case of gold, or in the case of Bitcoin, or in the case of the collectibles that Vijay talks about in his article, there is at least some kind of common unit, some kind of homogeneity of the asset. But with debt, it's not clearly defined. You know, its valuation depends on, it's in the eye of the beholder. And so, I just found that also to be quite a problematic aspect of the theory.
Yeah. You can't have, and this is another important point from Mises, which is, you know, the market economy is an institution that can only exist with money. Only when you have an impersonal system of trade where people can divide the labor, not based on ties of kinship and friendship and direct relationships, but the division of labor is allocated and handled by prices, by people performing economic calculation. But you can't perform economic calculation unless everything is denominated in one unit. And so that you have one good that you can compare everything to. And then you can figure out, you know, should I eat this, or should I produce that, or should I consume this? Only if you have this one good with which you express everything else are you able to do that. And debt cannot be that good. You want something that has low supply elasticity to be that good, because you don't want it to be something that can be produced easily. And so that explains why historically, you know, we see things like gold and silver and Bitcoin monetize. All right, well, we've run for 2 hours, which is, we've certainly filled our quota. And I think we've taken up enough of your time, Vijay. This has been a lot of fun. I think we could do another six. If we just, you know, if we had a couple of steaks handy, you and I could probably keep going.
I'm really looking forward to, we'll do a steak dinner. I've always wanted to cook some brisket for you, smoke some brisket. So if you ever find yourself in near Seattle, then I hope you'll visit, and I'll cook you some meat, and maybe we can record a podcast at the same time.
Yeah, or make a cooking show, an Austrian economics show.
Well, thank you, Saif. It's a great honor for me. You've had an influence on my thinking, so I appreciate the chance to get to speak to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. And likewise, your work has also influenced me, and I've enjoyed reading it. So it's always fun to chat to you, Vijay. Thank you, and take care.
Thanks, sir. Bye.